Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. Welcome into the Storycraft Cafe. I am your host, Hank Garner, and today I am super excited to have Michael Callahan on the show with me. He has an amazing new book coming May 21st, The Lost Letters from Martha's Vineyard. I love this book so much. There's been a lot of buzz about it, about, you know, the perfect summer beach read for 2024. And I heard that a lot before I picked up the book. And Michael, I have a favorite reading chair, and a lot of times I'll get, you know, advanced reader copies in from a publisher, and I'll have a stack there by my favorite chair, and I'll pick one up, and I know that it's going to be an amazing book and an amazing conversation coming up about the book when I completely lose track of time and I look up and 3 hours have gone by and I've just got to know how this book ends. And this was absolutely one of those books. So I said all that to say welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here with you.
Absolutely. Michael, I love to start the show with a fun question to kind of set the tone and to get some conversation started. And one question that I love to ask people is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, wow. This is funny because I just had a website created and I put this on there. I find so much of the about the author stuff to be really dutiful and earnest. And I thought, I want to get people a peek into like what an insane person I really am. So when I was little, about five or six, I was, my mother, to keep me occupied, would give me these big reams of paper and crayons. And I would craft these stories. You know, they all had very dramatic titles. And then on the subsequent ones, it would say, by Michael Callahan, the author of, you know, and then the previous story. Even then, I was practicing for my big career. The turning point for me actually came, I won an essay contest in eighth grade.
Yeah, okay.
I wanted to be a cartoonist. I was really good drawer, like, you know, artist. And sure. I wanted to be an editorial cartoonist. But then I won an essay contest in eighth grade, and I thought, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a writer. So I'm one of the few people I know who decided what they were going to be when they were 13 and then actually became it.
I love it. And I love hearing stories of little kids that create books and have a whole marketing campaign, you know, at 8 years old.
Exactly.
That is so funny because I remember as a little kid thinking that books were just ethereal. They just kind of appeared, and that there was, I don't know where they came from. They just were. But one day I remember it dawning on me that there are names, you know, on the spine, and when you open the first couple pages, they're usually, you know, a list of people or companies. And I started to realize that some person wrote this story. Right. And then another person got involved, and, you know, maybe an editor and then a publisher. And then there are all sorts of people that work at the publisher. And then bookstores get involved, and that's a whole other team of people. And all of a sudden, it humanized storytelling for me. And then if all of these people are involved in the storytelling process, then I could, you know, it becomes achievable when you put a face to it or a name to it. Did you have a moment like that, or you just were always in control of the process?
It's funny. I don't know whether this comes from coming from a working class background or where it comes from, but I think I was always very sort of determined and focused as a child. some of that was the fact that I was the fourth of four and my brothers were sort of bunched up and then I was in the caboose and I spent more time alone than they did. And so I sort of leaned into my creativity. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that if I wanted to do something, I planned it out. Like I was very strategic even as a kid. And, you know, I started writing, I mean, I joined the junior high newspaper staff. Like I was like, I'm going to start building a portfolio now. Like it was all like that. And it was an audacious dream because, you know, working class kids did not, I wasn't surrounded by creative people at all. And my family thought I was rather nuts and that I'd outgrow it, frankly, but I clearly did not.
Well, thank God you didn't.
Yeah.
I've done over 1,500 author interviews over the last decade, and I can count on two hands the number of people who decided early on that they wanted to be a writer and their sole purpose in life was to pursue that dream. And, you know, whether that meant you're pursuing an MFA or, you know, some sort of, you know, English derivative degree or whatever, and then, you know, trying to make their hand at publishing. The vast majority of people take a kind of circuitous route and they, they, you know, gather experiences here and there, and then the writing bug kind of comes back around and bites them. What did you do when, you know, you said that you were on the newspaper staff in junior high and high school, and when you got out of high school and you started making these adult decisions that were, would set you on the path of your life, what did you choose to pursue?
I was always going to go into journalism. And so I was in my early career. I went to journalism school at Temple University in Philadelphia, where I had grown up, and then, you know, worked at the college paper and interned at a bunch of newspapers, and then went to work at a community newspaper out of college, you know, doing school boards and, you know, council meetings and zoning and all that kind of stuff. It was great training. It was deadly work, but it was really great training to learn how to get information and how to synthesize it quickly. So that was helpful. I mean, this is obviously before the internet, so it was really shoe leather reporting. And then what happened is that I did a story at the newspaper. There was this Catholic high school, and they did these huge Broadway level productions of plays, and they were known for it. People from all over the county would come, and I did a story about the school musical, and I was in the musical. I joined the musical as part of the sort of reportage. And so it was very guerrilla, and it was really fun. And I wrote this enormous Sunday feature. It was like a magazine story. And I thought, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to write longer form stuff. I want to really get in. And so that was the beginning of my embracing of long form journalism. And so I ended up moving to Atlantic City and working at a magazine. And then my magazine career sort of took off from there. And I ended up all over the East Coast and working at various magazines. And the books thing came much later and was an outgrowth of the magazine thing. I wrote a magazine story, interviewed an agent who, you know, for the story.
Yeah.
And she said, have you ever thought about writing books? And I said, you know, no. And then I tried my hand at it. My first book was awful. But at least it existed. You know what I mean? I proved that I could actually write it. It's just sitting in my computer, and I sometimes look at it and get a laugh. But when I really got serious,
it's better about than getting a look at it and cringing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And, but when I got serious about it, she said, look, you know, I think you could write a novel. And that all led to my first novel in 2015.
Wow. I've gotten to know quite a number of people that began their careers in journalism that then, shall we say, graduate to writing fiction. I love to ask this question, and I've never really gotten, I get the same answer from most people. And that is, in your time as a journalist, are there any tools that you picked up that now help you as a fiction writer? And I know that when you're reporting, you're trying not to inject fiction into it, you know, and you like to think that in a bigger city, if you're reporting, then maybe there's an event that happens, and there might be 10 different newspapers if the the city's big enough. And 10 different reporters will show up, and they'll all have a little different view on the same facts. I find that interesting. Are there any tools that you picked up from your time in journalism that now help you as a fiction writer?
I think the biggest tool that I picked up from my years in journalism, especially in magazine journalism, was that it was the need to pay attention to detail and extraneous facts. You know, it's like scooping up as much loose change as you have and then deciding which you need and then discarding the rest. When I teach, I always say to the students, like, you can't have too much information. You know, it's always good to kill your darlings. And by that, I mean, like, you have so much great stuff, you can't fit it all in, that it's painful to leave stuff out. And that's where you want to be. I write historical fiction, so I'm writing things that happen in mid-20th century. That requires a tremendous amount of research. And I think my years in journalism certainly were invaluable in that, because I know how to do it. Like, I know how to go to an archive, and I know how to use my time wisely, so that I'm not spending time in extraneous stuff that I'm not going to need, but that I can focus in on the things that I do need, you know, and find weird things. Like, I can remember spending like a week, my first book, trying to find out how much a taxi would have cost from Grand Central Station to the hotel where the book was set. And I was insistent that I wanted the right fare. And it took me forever I had to, you know, go to the archives of the taxi thing and how much would, if we went this way and if there's were traffic, it was insane. You know what I mean? But, you know, that's what writers do. We're compulsive and we're obsessive and, you know, and that's part of the fun of it, is the treasure hunt part.
That is a perfect answer. And that is the answer that I've always looked for. 9 times out of 10, when you ask someone that used to be a journalist and now writes fiction, they say, well, the thing I learned was how to put my butt in the chair and to make a deadline, and which is wonderful advice. But, you know, your answer is what I've always looked for. So thank you for that.
Glad to help you there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What is it that fascinates you about mid-20th century? Because your previous book, Searching for Grace Kelly and The Night That She Won Miss America, both of those, your previous novels, are set roughly in one of the timelines that Lost Letters from Martha's Vineyard is set. So what is it that fascinates you about that time period?
You know, I think when I was young, my mother was a big old movie buff, you know, and in Philly we had this local station that used to play all the old movies from the 40s and 50s. And that's when she grew up, you know, so she was really attached to that. And we would sit, I have really great memories of sitting with her as a child and watching those great melodramas of the 1950s, the Douglas Sirk, you know, Mark Robeson, you know, things like Peyton Place and All That Heaven Allows and Magnificent Obsession and Written on the Wind. And, you know, these sweeping, you know, soap opera sort of melodramas. Yeah. And what I was so attached to was how sort of elegant they were, how people dressed and the cars and the clothes and people dined and the sets. And I loved all that. I mean, look, there was a lot wrong in mid-century America.
Sure.
I mean, there was a lot of people who didn't have rights. There were a lot of people being discriminated against. There was a lot of inequality going on. But there was also, I mean, and I acknowledge that, but my books are about the things that were right, which is the elegance, the panache, the style, the chic, the sort of glamour of it all. I found it all very, very glamorous. And that's why I want to write about things that are, you know, I'm not ever going to be the author who's going to, you know, give you the story about, you know, struggle and civil war in South Africa. You know what I mean? It's just not what I do. I applaud so much the people who do those books. They're important, but that's not what you have to write what you're passionate about and what you're really interested in. And I always start every novel that I write with, where do I want to live? You know, so it's New York, it's Newport, Rhode Island, it's Atlantic City, it's, you know, it's Los Angeles, it's Martha's Vineyard. I mean, these are all like places that have a certain elan in mid-century America. And I want to spend time there, and I want my readers to spend some time there with me.
I love it. I love it. And I think it is important to realize that not every story has to what's the word I'm looking for? It has to be an issue story. We can acknowledge that yes, there was a lot wrong in that time period, but we don't have to. Everything doesn't have to be a lesson, I guess we could say,
or a polemic. Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, for sure. I mean, I read a fair amount of nonfiction, and you know, but if I write beach reads, and I don't apologize for that. I mean, you know, I think there's a reason that Ellen Hildebrand is worth $1 zillion because she figured out like people wanted stories of glamorous people in Nantucket. You know what I mean? And good for her. You know what I mean?
Good for her. Yeah, right. Michael, I am fascinated, utterly fascinated by the moment of creation. And in one moment, a book like The Lost Letters from Martha's Vineyard did not exist. But then maybe a character walked onto the stage of your mind, or maybe you start thinking about Martha's Vineyard or Los Angeles, and the wheels start turning, and then you wonder, well, who is this character and what is she doing? And, you know, the what if games start playing in your mind. And then all of a sudden, this story does exist. And then you as the writer, your job is to dig it out of the ground, excavate it, dust it off, polish it up. And then we have a book that we're all holding in our hand. What was that? What is that first moment of creation usually like for you?
It's a really interesting question because I luckily have a really good answer.
I love it.
So I was finishing, I belonged to a writing colony on Martha's Vineyard that I joined in 2015. It was called the Martha's Vineyard Writers Residency. And it was in this
old— That just sounds glamorous.
I know. And it was this old big inn in Edgartown, if you've ever been that there. It was the heart of Martha's Vineyard. And I went there for a month to write my second book, to write the Miss America book. And it was amazing. You live with other writers, and it's, you know, it's a community. It's really great. So then I went back again the following year to finish. It had taken me a year to write the book. I was finishing the book the following year. And I just loved Martha. I mean, I've always loved it. And I was there, and I was staying in my room one night, and it was in bed. The lights were out. It was all quiet. And I thought, God, this is the kind of place where you just want to, you know, drop your life and come to, you know what I mean? And like escape to. And then I thought, wow, what it would be like if you just chucked everything and came here. And I thought, well, why would you do that? And then I thought, well, I write about mid-century. I don't know why it does that. I thought, I wonder what this place was like in mid-century. And it just was a hamster wheel that wouldn't go. And so then I started thinking, what if you were famous and then you chucked it all and came here? Why would you do it? And what would happen? And what if you had an adventure that changed your life, that then caused everything to be upended that you thought you knew? And that was it. And that it sort of came together. The story of Mercy Wells and all of that came together. And I thought, and this is the thing, is that I was lying there and I thought, I need to get up and write this down or I will not remember it tomorrow morning. And so I got up at 2 a.m. and I put the light on at the desk and I started to write the outline for this, just in very broad strokes. But thank God I did, because I mean, the next morning I did get up and I thought, I have no idea what I wrote. Right. But that's how it all started. Yeah.
I've talked to writers before who say, I never write down an idea because if it's a great idea, it'll be there in the morning or it'll be there in 2 days. And
I could not disagree with that more.
No, I do not trust myself like that. Like that is some serious self-trust and I am not there. That is not what I'm about. But I love that. I love an idea that just grabs a hold of you and you must start writing it to see where it's going to wind up, you know, just so that you'll know. I love those kinds of ideas. Yeah. Are you, you said you started kind of roughing out an outline in broad strokes. Do you consider yourself a planner, an outliner, versus, you know, the other camp that we love to put writers in, you know, the plotters versus the pantsers? Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Oh, I'm a plotter for sure. And I think this probably comes from the journalism background, right? Like I need to know how the story ends. before, especially because now I've sort of drifted into this sort of mystery genre a little bit. Like,
yeah,
you know, the Searching for Grace Kelly was more of a character study of three girls living in the Barbizon Hotel. And you know, this book, I think the Miss America book was more of a suspense novel, and this one's more of a romantic mystery, you know, that has a bunch of secrets at the end, in twists and all that kind of stuff, you know. And if you're going to do that, then you've got to, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I had to start the book over because I kept coming up with ideas of how to twist it. And then what I had didn't then make sense. So then I had to go back and start. It was just awful. That's why it took me so much longer to write this one than the other two. It was to me much more ambitious to do a dual timeline, to do something in 1959 and then current day and all of that. But I think in the end it was worth it, because I wrote the story that I wanted to write.
Absolutely. Did your desire to write a mystery, did that come from the idea for this book, or did you have the idea to write a mystery before? I guess, did the subject matter lend itself to mystery, or did you set out to write a mystery and these are just the people that shape that?
No, I did not set out to write a mystery. I certainly set out to write a soapy, sudsy melodrama. Yeah. But I think the mystery part came organically. It came, you know, because in the original outline, there wasn't nearly as much sort of secret keeping going on. And then I just thought, yeah, I mean, I love all this, but it's just a lot of detail. And there's not enough plot. There's not enough to hang this on. I just knew it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what could make it? What could juice it? I got to sort of zhuzh this up. And that's when it all started. And I thought, well, what if she was hiding this and he was hiding that? You know, everybody was hiding.
Right.
So then it just sort of organically happened that way.
Yeah. When you're writing a book like this and the ideas are kind of slipstream, they're coming in and out. And do you then adjust your outline? Like once you finish your outline, is it a roadmap that you reference as you're writing? Or I've known some people that write out an outline and then they never look at it again. Like they use it to kind of solve all of the problems in their head, and then they know the story and they just go from there. Is this a reference that you use, or is it just an exercise to get to know the story?
It's both. I would say I fall somewhere in the middle. I certainly, if you looked at my original outline, the finished book isn't that, but it's close. It's in the ballpark. So I use the outline as a way to keep myself honest and to keep myself on track, to make sure that I'm not drifting off into, you know, random anecdotes or, you know, whatever. It's elastic, and I certainly have altered it in real time. You know what I mean? I've come up to something in the outline and think, yeah, you know what? I don't need to do this. This is going to bog down the story, and I'm going to ditch this subplot, or I'm going to switch it. Or I'm going to have these people actually serve that purpose instead of these people. But I think it's good, at least for me, I have to have some general idea of where I'm going and how it's going. I can't just sit down cold and let it come out. Like that's just not going to be a comfortable experience for me.
The dual timelines in this book are very well done. There are some dual timeline books that you read, and like the present day story, there'll be a problem that's posed to the protagonist. And then when you go to the flashback timeline, a lot of times it will answer the problem from the present day. You don't necessarily do that. And I really appreciated that. It's not a tit for tat. It's not a direct correlation between the two timelines, not always. And I really appreciated that. My question was, how do you plan out the two timelines, and do you have two separate stories that you're working in? And then how do you decide how those overlap and kind of how you stage the jumping back and forth?
Well, I had never done this before.
And that's so, like six questions. I know. I'm sorry.
That's okay. It was a challenge because when I first tried to do it, I kept getting the pacing off. Because I mean, the whole point of a dual timeline is that it meets at the end, right?
Right.
Like this.
Right.
They're on parallel tracks, but then they intersect at the end. And I could not get the timing right. I kept like, you know, it was just, it was so frustrating. And I almost gave up on the book twice. You know what I mean? I at one point sent some sample chapters to my agent and I said, I don't know about this. Like, maybe I should, maybe this is just, I mean, because sometimes you're not writing the right book. And
right.
I finally said, okay, let's send this in to the publisher. They had rights of first refusal. I said, let's just send them what I've got and the outline and see what they say. Because if they're like, then maybe I'll just leave it. So she said, okay, we'll send it in. And then a week later, she called me and she said, you know, I heard from the publisher, they're bidding, they want the book.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was really surprised. And I said, well, how much? And so she sends me the number. And then I said, oh, we should really take that, shouldn't we? She's like, oh, you're taking it. Start writing. And she hung up. And so then that's a great motivator, too, to fix your timeline problems. Because you're like, well, yeah. I'm committed now. I've got to figure this out. And
Right. Eventually
you just figure it out. You know, it just takes a lot of patience with yourself. And again, the elasticity thing with being able to change your mind.
Yeah. When you're writing, especially in the dual timelines, do you write the book linearly, like straight down the outline, or do the dual timelines give you the option that if you're not feeling good about this scene, you can jump over to the other? Because, I mean, it's next in line. Do you ever have moments like that?
Yeah, I do write linearly. I write... you know, I write in order. I write in order of the outline. I have to keep the story. My friend Piper Kerman, who wrote Orange is the New Black.
Oh, yeah.
She gave me great advice once, and she said, you can't fix what doesn't exist.
Right.
And I never forgot that because, I mean, you just have to, you can get into a cul-de-sac with your books and just end up like, well, I'm rewriting chapter one again. And like, I don't. I keep barreling ahead. Because once you get, like, if you write 500 words a day, that's 3,500 words a week. That's 35,000 words in 10 weeks. You know, you can write a book in 30 weeks. So it requires the discipline. That's where the sitting in the chair thing comes, right?
Right.
But to me, it also involves not looking in the rearview mirror. And, you know, I did have to go back because the plot then didn't make sense when I kept changing my mind. But I don't go back and wordsmith and nibble and niggle and all that stuff. I mean, I'm not going to do that. I do leave passages in my drafts that say, Michael, this is terrible. Please fix this later. And then, you know, in all caps. And then I know, like, okay, or this doesn't make sense. You'll have to fix chapter two now. Remember to do that. And I leave myself quick, but I keep going straight. Because to me, that's the momentum push. That's the, you know, that's where the energy comes from.
The not looking in the rearview mirror and pressing forward is brilliant advice and very difficult to realize. Because when I sit down to write, I'll usually read over what I wrote yesterday just to kind of get my mind back in the flow of where I was. And invariably, there'll be a couple of sentences. Oh, I can tighten this up. And then before I know it, that's 30 minutes out of my writing session that is gone into dealing with yesterday's writing. And I say I'm not going to do it, and I do it over and over again. And it's so frustrating, but it's I wish I could just keep my eyes forward and then address it all later. But, you know, hopefully we'll get there one day.
Yes, try it out.
Yeah. What's your editing process like when you finish that first draft? Do you do like Stephen King says and take that manuscript and stick it in a drawer for a month or 6 weeks or something and then come back with fresh eyes? Or do you immediately dive back in and start fixing things that you see?
I do two things. Not always, but generally. I mean, I've had writing groups for my first and third books. I did writing groups where I was giving them sort of chunks of stuff, and then they were giving me once a month feedback on what I had, and then I was taking all sorts of notes. But again, not going back to the manuscript, but keeping all those notes somewhere that I would go back and attack it all together. So that was one thing I did, and then the other thing, I do agree with him about the taking a step back. Once I'm done, then I do put it in a drawer, but I don't, not a month. I mean, a couple, maybe 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then I'll, you know, I usually go somewhere. I usually treat myself to a trip after I finished a book that says, okay, we're going to clear the decks here. We're not going to think about this. We're not going to, like, you're not taking the characters with us. And I find that to be a helpful head clearing exercise as well.
I love that. Speaking of writing groups, I think a lot of new writers, will join a writer's group or convene a group of friends or something. And then they will give their book that they're working on to these people. And then they may get all sorts of feedback on it. And then most writers don't know what to do with that feedback. Mm-hmm. How do you choose who you trust with a work in process? And how do you decide what is valuable feedback and what is just someone's opinion who doesn't get the book anyway? That is a difficult thing to figure out.
Yeah, that's very difficult. It's a great question, actually. For one, I think you have to curate the right reading group. I mean, both of my writing groups I formed, and I invited people who I knew were going to be, who were going to get it and get what I was trying to do. I think you have to make sure that your group is composed of the right people whose critiques are going to be valuable to you. And then second, I think to your point about who's do you take and who to ignore? I generally have gone to if people feel really passionately about it, and if there's a group think, right? My last writing group, there were five of us. And, it's not often, but at some point, four of them all together will say, no, this doesn't land. She wouldn't do this. It doesn't make any sense, you know? And then you have to take a step back. That's why you have them. And you're like, okay, they're seeing, obviously there's something here. I will tell you that my first writing group, there were only three of us. And I met these two people at a writing class that I took at NYU years ago, and the great, great, great people. I dedicated the book to them because without them, I wouldn't have finished. And it went well. They had really good critiques. They were surgical. They were on point. I mean, it was really helpful. And then I ended up moving from New York to Philadelphia right when I was finishing the book. And so we were doing conference calls, on the book group then. This is pre-Zoom. And so I gave them the ending and we did the call and they both were quiet and they both said, we're not letting you end the book like this. They said, this is a disaster. No. And they were angry about the ending. And I was like, oof, okay. Because as a writer, I mean, you have some ego in the game. And so you're like, your first instinct is like, screw you, like this might. Right. But, the vociferousness of the response and their points that they made were, I thought, no, they're right. They've got to be. And they were. And I changed the ending. Wow. And I thanked them so much for that. You know what I mean? Because the ending that they were suggesting turned out to be so much stronger than the one I had.
Wow. I love that. The Lost Letters from Martha's Vineyard comes out, I guess that would be 3 weeks from yesterday.
Yes.
When people pick up this book, Michael, and take it to the beach with them, this summer, when they get to the end of the book and they close that back cover, what do you hope they take away with them? What from this book do you hope lasts with people that continues to resonate with them when the book's over?
I would say this. I would say that if I've succeeded as a storyteller with the book, then you should feel some wistfulness in your heart when you end. That was the goal. The goal was to have that sort of sort of feeling. I finished the book, the book ends on a letter, and I started to cry as I wrote it. And I thought, okay, well, this is sad, but maybe this is good. I mean, if I can get people to feel something when I tie this all up in a bow at the end, maybe that would be enough. And that's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that people feel like their time was well spent. I mean, that's what you want with a book. Yeah. And that they got a really good heartstring story out of it.
Love it. The Lost Letters from Martha's Vineyard. Here's the cover. Go pick it up in a couple of weeks when it comes out. Michael, if people are just discovering you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you're up to, I know that you mentioned earlier that you've got a new website going up, and I know you have an Instagram account, and we have an Amazon page with your books listed. What else can we, or where else can we send people to find out all about what you're up to?
Yeah, it's CallahanWrites.net. Okay. And that has, you know, way more about me than you ever need to know, including where I'm going to be doing some events and new books and new work and all of it. And you can also send me a message and tell me what you thought. So would love to hear from people.
Excellent. We'll link up all that in the show notes to make it easy for folks to find you. Michael, this has been so much fun chatting. Thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
Thank you so much, Hank. It's been my pleasure.
That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.